We are all fascinated by the ability of law enforcement to use what seems like an increasingly sophisticated science to find people guilty or to actually exonerate people. Fingerprints, DNA, all of these things are fascinating. And tonight we have one of the best guys in Chicago to talk about the latest developments in forensic science. Brendan Max is the chief of the Forensic Science Division of Cook County Public Defender's Office. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Karen. Appreciate it.
Good. I am, Brendan is an attorney, and you've been involved in the criminal justice system for over 20 years. You've worked on one of the first DNA exonerations in Illinois, the Beauty Shop Rapist, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. And you also represented one of the defendants in the Brown's Chicken murder, which was a fascinating case that stunned Chicago for a number of years. Let's talk a little bit about DNA and about the advances in the science. First of all, you are in the public defender's office, and you are helping your attorneys who are defending people charged with crimes. You're teaching them and helping them understand the science so they can relate it to the jurors. Is that right?
For sure. So one of the nice things about the Cook County Public Defender's Office is back in around 2000, they formed the first forensic science division within a public defender law office in the country so that lawyers could get specially trained, learn, and hopefully protect their clients from fraudulent forensics in criminal cases.
And we all watch the television shows. How accurate are generally these television shows? Are we learning what we should be learning?
Not really. There's a couple things that are similar to real life, and then there's some real differences. So, yes, law enforcement has some really amazing tools like you see on TV, but they have really real limitations, and you don't get a sense of those on TV. So when you see a computer screen on TV flash the word match, and they think that they've associated some forensic evidence to a suspect, and they've matched them, and they've solved the case, that is not how it happens in real life. Most forensic evidence creates some type of an association with a suspect, and sometimes that association is pretty weak. Sometimes that association is stronger, but it is rarely a match, and it almost never defines a case totally one way or another.
And I think that is surprising to even me, because in my view, what I understand is if there's a good DNA sample and there's a suspect and they compare the two of them, it either matches or it doesn't, pretty much. But that's not what you're saying.
So that's a common misconception. So DNA is a really good association to an individual if you have a nice, pristine, let's say, blood sample. Let's say a phlebotomist came in here, stuck a needle in my arm, took some blood out of it, took it to a lab, and they ran a DNA profile on it. They could be able to trace that DNA profile back to me and match it, but that's because that's a nice, pristine, full single source sample. The problem is crime scene evidence isn't that way. It's a mixture sometimes of two or three or four people, or there's a very small amount of it, or it's degraded, and then it becomes very hard for examiners to associate that evidence to any one person. Oftentimes they can't.
Touch DNA. Let's talk a little bit. What is touch DNA, and does this make DNA easier as a tool, or does it make it more difficult?
So touch DNA is really the double-edged sword of forensic DNA, and I say that because DNA instruments have gotten really super sensitive. So flashback 15 years ago, when a forensic scientist was doing DNA testing, they needed a visible amount of biology, so a blood stain that they could see or some other biological stain that they could see. The testing has gotten so sensitive now that an examiner can swab any surface that they want, pick up a few skin cells, and create a DNA profile from that. That's really good because it's really sensitive, but what it raises is the prospect of sweeping up a whole bunch of random DNA, environmental DNA, from people who had nothing to do with the crime or may have never even been at the crime scene. The way that happens is each of us, it might be a little bit maybe gross to think of, but each of us are shedding a lot of our DNA every day. We shed tens of millions of cells, each of us, every day, skin cells. And what that means is you're leaving traces of yourself wherever you are. So I'm sitting in this studio in a chair. Unfortunately, I'm going to leave my DNA here. If somebody else came in, a next guest, and sat down here, and my DNA was transferred to them, they could then walk away from here. You would be surprised how much clothing is found at crime scenes. They could leave then their shirt there. My DNA would then be at that crime scene. I was never there. I'm not associated with that crime scene in any way. But my skin cells would end up on a swab in a lab, and my DNA profile could implicate me at that point. That's the double-edged sword of the new sensitivity of touch DNA, where an examiner can get DNA off your wristwatch or swabbing your eyeglasses or anything that came into contact with your body.
I think you gave me an example in some of the materials you sent over where there was some confusion about that. And I think could you talk a little bit about that? The one that I liked was the one with the swabs.
Yeah, so there were there's a couple famous examples that were really eye-openers to the forensic community. One was called the Phantom of Heilbronn, and it occurred about 10 years ago in Germany and Austria. Law enforcement there thought they had a one-woman female crime spree because some woman's DNA was showing up in murder scenes in Germany and robbery scenes in Austria, and they kept doing DNA profiles from evidence recovered from around those scenes, and they're like, the same woman's DNA keeps showing up. We have a female one-woman crime spree here. What it turned out is that a woman worked at the lab that produced the swabs that were used to collect the evidence, and a very small amount of her DNA was in the manufacturing process, getting on those swabs, and then being tested from one crime scene to another. And it wasn't until months after the investigation they thought they had some crime spree going on, and it was just some woman in a factory who was boxing up the crime scene swabs that were used for the investigation.
Well, we're going to take a break in a little bit and talk about drawing the composites based upon DNA, which I think is fascinating. But one of the things that we've seen over and over again is in all different cities there have been scandals where the lab has been accused of making things up. Or does this happen a lot? Is it that they're intentionally falsifying these records, or does it happen that there's bias in what they're doing?
So it's a combination. There, over the past few years, there have been many lab scandals that have been identified around the country, from Boston, Detroit, some here in Illinois. And some of those have been the fraudulent activities of one examiner who, because the lab procedures and protocols weren't rigorous enough, were allowed to do something called like dry labbing, where they were faking tests and reporting out results of tests that they never did. Others are not as nefarious. They're just labs using protocols that allow for problems to seep into their analysis. So it's actually a combination of some fraudulent activities by a handful of examiners, and then some labs that just don't take quality assurance and quality control quite as rigorously as they should.
I would imagine, too, there might be some prosecutor's offices that put pressure on the labs to come up with a solution to the crime, thinking, here's the guy that we think did it. Can you make sure that we have the DNA to prove that? Is that some of that go on, and does that also influence a bad result?
Yeah, so it's interesting you ask that, because there is a movement in the field right now, a discussion amongst forensic scientists who are trying to decide, how much information does a forensic scientist need about the case itself? So in a murder case, do they need to know about the crime scene? Do they need to know about the victim? Do they need to know about the defendant? Or should they be insulated from all that? If we were designing a forensic science system from scratch now, and money weren't a problem, there would be a system whereby forensic scientists would, there'd be a wall between them and the evidence in the case. They wouldn't know about that. There'd be a two-part system where there are forensic scientists at a crime scene who help there, but then who have no part in the testing of the case later, because those influences, those biases, those pressures, which you can imagine how they would act on anyone in that situation, a forensic examiner, a police officer, have been shown and known to change cases and hinder cases.
I mean, you can't help but be biased if you know facts and you know the gruesome details, and you're being told that this is the guy who they have in custody, and maybe you think it's your job to make sure that he gets convicted.
For sure, and one of the reasons why that's such a problem, or why forensic scientists realize now that it's such a problem, is because we all realize now that so much of forensic science is subjective. If it were objective, maybe we wouldn't worry so much about bias, because the tests are objective, they are what they are. But from DNA interpretation to fingerprint interpretation to ballistic interpretation, one step to another, those sciences are in large part subjective, and that's when bias can creep in.
We're talking to Brendan Max from the Cook County Public Defender's Office. We're talking forensic science, DNA, and fingerprints. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
Hip, hip, hooray for DNA. It provides the key to the plans for making everything in you and me.
We are talking DNA with Brendan Max. There's a song for everything. I noticed that. I didn't grow up with Google, but now that I know that there's a song for everything, we're going to have a DNA song, aren't we? We're talking to Brendan Max with the Cook County Public Defender's Office, and one of the most interesting things that you're talking to me about is this phenotyping. Can you tell our listening audience what that is?
Sure. So the holy grail of DNA technology right now that lots of smart scientists, not only in the U.S., around the world, are working on, are trying to create some kind of composite picture of a suspect from some DNA material left at the scene. So right now, the limitation with DNA is you get a swab from a scene, you create a profile. You really can't do anything with that profile until you identify somebody to compare it to. There's some databases you can run it through. If somebody's in the database, you might hit. But the problem is you can't build an image of that person from the DNA. That is being worked on right now by scientists around the country, and they're trying to do something called DNA phenotyping, and that is research our chromosomes to find out when we do DNA testing, can we paint a picture of the person whose chromosomes we're looking at? Can we identify their area of origin? Can we actually create a composite sketch of what they might look like? There are some scientists who are doing that now. There's some scientists who think they can do that now. It's not ready for prime time in that it's not validated for court use yet, but that's something that law enforcement's working on really hard, and it's probably in the future.
Well, it seems to me that it would be a great tool for the investigative process. So if you can tell if a person's male, you could tell if a person's maybe Hispanic, you can tell if a person's in a certain age range, and I think you said in your materials that maybe you can even tell if he exercises. I don't know how you tell that, but so if all those things going, you can maybe draw a picture that may or may not be, but at least it helps move the process forward and make you focus on somebody you wouldn't focus on normally.
Yeah, surprising things that I don't think it's too far off where scientists are going to be able to tell from your DNA whether you are a smoker or not, whether you have substance abuse problems, whether you exercise, what type of diet you have. All of those things, in the not-too-distant future, investigators may be able to tell from crime scene evidence.
Absolutely fascinating. Let's talk a little bit about fingerprints. Again, my thought was that fingerprints are a solid science, and that if a fingerprint matches, it's a done deal.
So that's, you probably have a thought, because that's the way fingerprint examiners have for decades explained how they do things. And for decades, fingerprint examiners went into court and say, I looked at a latent print compared to the suspect print. They match, which means that print came from that person to the exclusion of everyone else on Earth. Finally, what scientists have done, including some people in the fingerprint world, they've circled back and asked themselves, does our research and science actually support that level of definitive claim? And the answer is clearly no. So some of it depends on the quality of the latent print. Those can be very high quality. Some of them are pretty low quality. But the problem is there are subjective judgments being made throughout that process. And these large-scale studies that we've seen in the field over the last few years have shown that fingerprint examiners make mistakes, and that at every important part of the process, from determining if the print is suitable for comparison to identifying features in it to trying to match it to somebody, that fingerprint examiners, when you get large groups of them looking at the same print, they come to different opinions.
Wow.
And if it's that subjective and there's that much error, they shouldn't be claiming this match anymore. They should be claiming some type of association that's not as strong as a match. And that's where the field is right now. They're trying to figure out what term to use aside from match.
And not to get too legal here, and Brendan is with the Cook County Public Defender's Office, so you are tasked with helping your lawyers defend the criminal defendant. So the burden is beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a very high burden, and if the jurors actually honor that burden, it's a hard thing to prove. So if you've got a prosecutor that has fingerprint evidence and the prosecutor's walking around saying, this is definitive, this means he did it, there's no question, your people need to be schooled in why that might not be accurate.
True.
And may need to be able to cross-examine that expert to show that there are a lot of inaccuracies in these types of things.
And we handle a lot of cases that hinge just on a fingerprint. For instance, we litigate a lot of fingerprint-only burglary cases where the only evidence that law enforcement has is a fingerprint on a windowsill. And in years past, when examiners came in and said that's a match and lawyers weren't prepared to challenge that, people would be convicted of burglary and do prison time based on a fingerprint. And I'd like to think now we know a little bit better both about the science and our ability to challenge those claims, and we try and make sure that our clients don't go to prison based on a questionable association to a fingerprint when there's no other evidence that they were involved in criminality.
I want to talk about a few cases in particular, and obviously you weren't involved in the O.J. Simpson case, but that's one of the cases where DNA became a household word, and we were all talking about it. We were all wondering all different things. I mean, there were, you know, I thought there was his DNA. How could it be anyone but him? What were your thoughts about the O.J. case, and what went wrong with the prosecution, and what did the defendants do right?
Sure. So one thing is that the defense attorneys in that case just knew a ton about DNA, so they were ahead of their time in that way, and they were more prepared, I think, than the prosecutors. The other problem that the prosecution had, and I don't have a ton of personal insight into that case, but I have read about it, and I know that there were some very real problems with the way the crime scene work was done. There were some very real questions about contamination with some of the blood evidence that was found at the scene, and the defense was able to capitalize on that and raise some questions. And this was still in some of the early DNA days, so prosecutors might not have been quite ready for it, but certainly the defense attorneys were in that case.
Well, and I think, and obviously I wasn't there at the trial, but one of the things that you probably do is you need to school your lawyers in how to tell a jury about these things and have the right experts to explain it, because these are complicated concepts, and people are now coming in with preconceived notions based upon movies they've seen, or CSI, or the OJ case. And so you have to have your lawyers be able to examine a witness to explain this to the average person.
Yeah, it's a tough task. So in DNA, you not only have to try and teach the jury something about genetics, but they have to learn something about statistics as well, because the association between DNA and a suspect comes down to statistics. So, yeah, it's challenging, and in the end, you have to try and break it down into the simplest terms that still fully explain kind of the evidence and what it means in the case.
I want to just talk about the one case that you worked on, that it was the first exoneration of a defendant in Illinois based upon DNA, and that was the beauty shop rape case. Can you quickly tell us what happened in that case?
Yeah, so it actually showed kind of both the good side and the bad side of forensics. So in 1993, there were a series of about 10 sexual assaults on the South Side. They all occurred in very similar fashion that made it seem like they were all being committed by one person. They were all committed in beauty shops. Our client, John Wills, was arrested for about half of them, and then another man, Dennis Magruder, was arrested for others. But it seemed pretty clear at the time that one person had committed them both. John Wills was convicted of five of them. He was sentenced to 100 years. And what his lawyers didn't know at the time that he was convicted was that there was evidence, serology evidence in one case, that actually proved him innocent in that case. So the suspect in that scene left a sample of DNA at the scene. A serologist determined that the blood type of the person, the suspect, was type A. John Wills was type B. But that examiner never let that information be known to the defense or to the court. And it was only years later, where we were handling his case after trial, and we were able to get DNA testing that we were able to show both that he was innocent and that there had been some fraudulent testimony regarding the serology in his case. And eventually, John was exonerated. One of the shocking things to me when I handled the case is I could see how the wrongful conviction happened. John Willis and the real suspect, Dennis Magruder, when you saw pictures of them in 1993, they looked like blood brothers. So it was a very interesting case. It was a very sad case, but it showed both the bad side of forensics, hiding some serology, and then the good side, which is using DNA to exonerate him. So it was really my first eye-opening experience with the intersection of forensics and the criminal justice system.
Interesting. Brendan Max, thank you for joining us on this Sunday evening. You'll join us again to talk more about some of the digital forensic science with cell phones and those types of things.
Sure, I'd love to. Thanks for having
me. Let's do it again.